Log Talk Radio.
Woke up at the crack of noon. I got so much to do today. Head on down to the tiki bar just to watch the tourists play. Living just south of reality, mile marker 49.
Welcome to Syndicated News.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome. We're so happy to have you here. This is Alan F. St. Pierre, and I'm going to read you a little bit about him. He's the executive director of Normal and the Normal Foundation. He's written and debated, and he's lectured extensively on the topic of cannabis, its prohibition, and its ugly little stepchildren, such as asset forfeiture, the ban on the cultivation of non-psychoactive cannabis, that's hemp in the U.S., drug tax stamps, the legal struggle for medical access of cannabis, partnership for a drug-free America, drug education, especially D-A-R-E, DARE, mandatory minimum sentencing, drug screening, the use of the military and domestic law enforcement, the history of cannabis prohibition, and numerous other legal sophistries concerning the prohibition of cannabis. Mr. St. Pierre has been cited in hundreds of international, national, and local news publications such as New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, London Times, Le Monde, Der Spiegel, Economist, Newsweek, and Time. Many more, too long a list to mention here. Mr. St. Pierre has appeared on hundreds of nationally televised news programs, ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, C-SPAN, Fox, PBS, and on and on. And at least 1,000 radio shows representing Normal's point of views on the topic of marijuana. Mr. St. Pierre was hired by Normal in 1991 as a communications director. In 1993, he became the organization's deputy national director. In January of 2005, Mr. St. Pierre became the executive director of Normal. And now he serves on both Normal and the Normal Foundation's board of directors and is secretary to both. Welcome to the show, Mr. St. Pierre.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tell us all about the problem with cannabis and the problem with weed.
Well, I guess from my perspective, the major problem with cannabis is its prohibition. And we are now getting into our 74th year of marijuana prohibition. And when juxtaposed to America's often referred to great failed social experiment of alcohol prohibition, which lasted only about 12 years. So in America, every 35 seconds, a citizen who consumes cannabis is arrested. That's an average of 850,000 per annum. 90% are for possession only. 20 million Americans have been arrested for possession of marijuana since 1965. And of the 2.3 million people who are currently incarcerated in jails and prisons in the United States, approximately 100,000 of these individuals are in jail for marijuana-only related crimes. And to put that into some perspective, yes, 100,000 is a small percentage, reasonably speaking, of 2.3 million, but the pendant in our country is so great for incarceration that all of the countries that make up the EU, which is a larger population base in the United States, all of those countries incarcerate for all crimes about 200,000 to 250,000 people. So the idea that this country puts 100,000 people in jail or prison for marijuana-only related crimes, I think speaks volumes to the excesses and the expense that Americans pay to maintain a completely flaccid, feckless, and irresponsible prohibition.
We noticed you have a convention coming up. I think it's 39 years.
Normal is going into its 39th annual conference in Portland, Oregon, September 9th through the 11th. Registration is just about to appear on Normal's front page at norml.org. There's information about the conference, accommodations, what people can anticipate, And yes, it is our 39th annual conference. This is the biggest, largest conference in the United States where citizens who disagree with prohibition meet and strategize about what to do to reform these laws. And you know, much of the reform of marijuana laws in the last 40 years has come out of normal's activities and these type of meetings. 13 states have decriminalized marijuana. 120 million people, roughly one out of three Americans, live in states and municipalities that have now decriminalized it. There's about 13 states that have medical marijuana laws on the books, and about 90 million Americans live in those states. And, for example, in California, where one out of eight Americans live, they will vote this year on whether marijuana should be legalized.
Excellent. And I wanted to ask you, I think it's going to go the way of prohibition. I think they're going to have to legalize it. But I'm noticing County of Mendocino in California, they are now the richest county in the United States, due, not in part, but completely to the fact that they're growing medical marijuana and it's taxed properly. And the revenues, the coffers for that county are just astronomical in comparison to any county in the United States. Is that fact still the same or has that changed?
Well, I'm not entirely sure regarding the county breakdown in the United States of affluency. Certainly the big counties north of San Francisco, Mendocino, Sonoma, Trinity, and Humboldt, which is the largest commercial, culturally accepted region of the country where marijuana has been growing mainly illegally for the better part of 40 years.
And what I was thinking as a non-consumer is I really would like to have that tax, that business taxed, and have it benefit my community than to have it benefit the local, do we still say mob?
Well, your point's very well taken that when cannabis is not taxed, those potential revenues clearly do not reside locally and improve the lives and the communities of local people, but those monies which consumers like myself are more than happy to be paying for a commodity like cannabis, that those monies go right out of the local area and they, in many cases, land either in criminal quarters. Post what we're talking about mainly are illegal Mexicans coming into the United farms and then selling the cannabis and effectively shipping the money back to Mexico without any of that residing here in the form of taxation.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you about drug tax stamps. Exactly what are those? What is a drug tax stamp? I don't know what that is.
Well, in my own personal view, I think they're probably the greatest example of the true legal sophistry that is marijuana prohibition. I don't think anything physically demonstrates it more than the so-called drug tax stamps. So most people listening will recognize the fact that when tobacco and liquor are sold at the retail level in all 50 states, that when you purchase those products, at the bottom of that cellophane that wraps the cigarette, there is a state-issued tax stamp, small but affixed to the bottom of the cellophane.
Yes, I've seen it.
Sure. When a person opens up a bottle of liquor in the United States, purchases a retail level, to actually get into that otherwise dangerous drug, you have to break the physical paper tax stamp that is placed over the top of the label. And beer and wine prepay the tax and therefore don't have to have any of these paper stamps placed to them. And this all makes eminent sense going back 800 years to England. Governments issue tax stamps to try to get the taxes and reasonably control the sale and distribution of valuable products, in this case, alcohol and tobacco products. So starting in the 1980s, a lot of legislators sort of ridiculously not satisfied with the fact that so many people are being arrested and incarcerated in this thing we call the war on some drugs, but they went even further and upset at the occasional time that somebody might beat their criminal charges, because the police did something illegal or excessive, which is fairly rare, but not satisfied with seeing anybody, not somebody, not wanting to be confronted with that kind of stuff, they find themselves compelled in 25 of the 50 states to go and purchase from the government a drug tax stamp. So there are many states that actually have a cannabis tax stamp. And many people, you can go to Normal's webpage at NLRML.org, go to the internal search engine and type in the words drug tax stamps. And you can actually look at many, many versions around the United States. And so what typically happens with these stamps is that if you get arrested by police and you either are found guilty of the crime or not guilty of the crime, you are still assessed a fine if you didn't possess the drug tax stamps, which would, in the case of the marijuana consumer, be affixed to the baggie or to the film canister, whatever was holding the marijuana. And since almost no one has ever heard of these, no one goes to government bureaucracy, stands in lines and buys these things, and then actually places them on the carrying devices that carry the marijuana, that when people, say, in Tennessee, which is a state that has these drug tax stamps, when they get caught with marijuana, often police will say, oh, well, you don't have a drug tax stamp, and drive them to an ATM and say, your fine for not having a drug tax stamp is something like $18 per gram. If you have an ounce of marijuana, that's 28 grams, so 28 times 18, and you're getting assessed like $400 or so. And they're brought to an ATM machine and asked to take out $400 and hand it to the police. And yet, the bottom line is, you still cannot possess, retain, or keep the marijuana. So there's nothing else I'm aware of the hundreds of thousands of products and commodities and services in the United States that people can pay for and government taxes. I'm not aware of anything where the government actually puts out a taxing device like a tax stamp, and you're supposed to actually be accountable for the tax. However, you cannot legally possess the product that is being taxed. So this would make the great Greek philosophers roll in their grave trying to make this make any sense whatsoever.
It's illogical, it seems to me.
It's completely illogical. If the government wants to issue a tax stamp, then logically the product that they're issuing the tax stamp for should be legal. If it's not legal, then it is obscene, absurd, and nitwittery for the government to issue a tax stamp for a product or a service that is illegal.
Okay, I don't smoke cigarettes or weed. I wanted to ask you, where would I get a tax stamp?
Well, in the 25 or so states that have these, there's actually one place you can get them. You have to physically go to, often the state capitol, to the Department of Revenue, or whatever it's called in one's particular state, and somewhere buried in one of these massive bureaucracies is a man or a woman sitting at a desk who has locked up, in some cases, thousands of these drug tax stamps that you're supposed to go and buy the amount you want, and then they give them to you, and they're not allowed to take your name or your address, and then legally, you're supposed to take them and affix them to your carrying device that has the marijuana in it. And if you got caught by police, as long as the marijuana weight equals the amount of taxes paid, then technically you would be in compliance with the law, except you still can't keep the cannabis.
How unusual is that? It seems as though they have an entire taxing system, but you can't keep the product. That's very odd. So I guess they did it maybe in the hopes that they can avoid avoid legalization.
Yeah, well, in essence, it's sort of like allowing legalization without doing so. The idea that legislators, most of them lawyers to be sure. Surely they've learned something about the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. They swear to uphold the Constitution and Bill of Rights, yet they sat around a big oak table and with their little red suspenders and comb-overs likely, came up with these incredibly bizarre, non-logical, dishonest ways of trying to tax cannabis without making it legal, which again, would anybody listening to this broadcast would rightly be confused at what they're hearing.
Now, on the topic of mandatory minimum sentencing, do you know what's the worst state to get arrested in with marijuana?
Well, if you face at a state penalty level, Utah, Georgia, and Kansas are states, along with Indiana, that if you get caught with selling cannabis, or you get caught growing a large amount of it, or you get caught multiple times in a commercial setting like that, then you can get multiple decades to life in prison. And there are many, many Americans who are serving life in prison for marijuana-only related crimes where there was no violent act.
Just for growing it?
Just for growing it. In fact, there's one man in Talladega, Alabama, at the Talladega prison, who is serving a lifetime sentence for, in his case, doing something incredibly stupid. He drove down the road, he'd go to work every day, and in the median of the highway, in the lawn, in the agriculture between the two strips of highway, he noticed all summer long, this is going back to 1996 or 97, he noticed what he thought was marijuana growing in the middle of the median. And so one day he had the swift idea of chopping down the plants, which at the time were 12 feet long, and put them in the back of his 9-foot pickup truck. And as he drove down the road, and a policeman got behind him and saw, apparently, these big bushes of marijuana hanging out the back of his truck, pulled him over. And what this gentleman had actually cut down was feral hemp, industrial hemp. In the United States, between 400 to 700 million feral marijuana plants. These are plants that are genetically left over from the World War II effort, which allowed for marijuana, otherwise known as, to be grown for industrial purposes in support of the war. And those plants and those seeds all these years later are still growing in mass all around mainly the middle part of the United States. And so this man, whose name is Vernon McElroy, chopped down a whole bunch of hemp plants thinking it was marijuana, and was arrested for possessing and having a conspiracy to sell the marijuana. And despite it being his first offense, he received a lifetime sentence in Alabama.
Is somebody working to get that man out?
Since 1996, Normal has been working to get him out, and absent the governor commuting his sentence, it doesn't appear that he will get out in his natural lifetime.
That's horrific.
It is. He is one of probably 20 to 30 prisoners in the United States who have lifetime sentences. In fact, there are three other lifetime cannabis prisoners also at Talladega.
Well, I have another question. I noticed on your website it mentions the use of the military in domestic law enforcement. Are they using the military to enforce cannabis laws?
Indeed, since the mid-1980s, the...
Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, in my view, it's a major violation of what's known as the Posse Comitatus Act. In 1982, the Reagan administration, in their minds, believed that they tweaked the law sufficiently to allow the domestic use of military and National Guard to arrest or to pursue or to eradicate or interdict marijuana and other trafficking. And since that period of time, in all 50 states, starting right around now, the Army and the National Guard will be employed to virtually fly around the countryside looking for the proverbial needle in a haystack, or in this case, looking for marijuana growing. And this has been going on now for 30 years, and many legal scholars believe it is a total violation of the Posse Comitatus Act. the Posicomitatus Act coming out of the Revolutionary War dictates that in our democracy, the military is only supposed to be used in the time of war to help quell riots and to help mitigate in times of natural disasters. And surely, flying around looking for marijuana growing doesn't fit any of those criteria.
And another thing we wanted to ask you was about the legalities. Is pot, weed, cannabis, is it a gateway drug for teenagers or is it not?
In my view, and I think well supported by science, that cannabis is not only not a gateway drug, it is probably better described as a drug of terminus, meaning that the vast majority of people who will go on and experiment and or abuse, become addicted to drugs like heroin or cocaine or crack or methamphetamines, that many of them will get off of using marijuana by those drugs. So in some ways, it's a stepping off stone drug for those other drugs. And more importantly, regarding a gateway to the other drugs, blessedly, thankfully, it's not. There are tens of millions of Americans who annually consume cannabis, but thankfully there's only a few hundreds of thousands, or maybe worst-case scenario, a few millions of Americans who abuse or become addicted to harder drugs. If there was a gateway effect with tens of millions, hundreds of millions of Americans using marijuana since the 1960s, if marijuana was a gateway drug, this country would be completely and totally addled by hard drug addiction. Thankfully, that is not the case at all. So in many respects, the drugs that Americans first use are alcohol, pharmaceuticals, tobacco, caffeine, then marijuana. Marijuana is usually the fourth or fifth drug they actually try, but it is typically the first illegal drug that they try.
And I was wondering, men and women who are suffering from, say, heroin addiction, is it possible that you could use pot to bring them down, to get them out of that addiction and bring them to pot, which is natural?
There is a number of white papers and scientific research, including one called Cannabis, the Stepping Off Stone, the Gateway Theory Revisited. And it goes into great detail demonstrating how cigarette smokers and coffee users and heroin users have gone from using those drugs at abuseful levels, really problematic, to using cannabis, and in many cases then stop using all drugs. And even if they continue to use cannabis, even at what some would believe to be abuseful levels, it is still one of the underlying tenets of an emerging public health doctrine called harm reduction, in the idea that, yes, a person who uses marijuana daily, that might not be an ideal circumstance, but compared to the person who would be a down-and-out drunk every day, it's sort of a Hobson's choice or a lesser of evils. And in this case, there's really hardly any comparison regarding the quality of life or how productive an individual can be, that if they replace being addicted to things like heroin or alcohol or tobacco and use cannabis occasionally, they very likely will see a very substantive increase in the quality of their life and health.
And I wanted to mention, could you give us some information on this drug-free America? What do you know about them?
Well, starting in the 1980s, one of the outgrowths of the Reagan administration, and in many respects, if you recall the 1982 movie 9 to 5 with Jane Fonda, Dolly Parton, and Lily Tomlin, the rumor goes that the Reagans, who received movies in advance of most of the public, so they could watch them at the White House, watched that movie, and I'll remind individuals who have seen it and those who haven't, essentially it's three women who work in an office who are being abused by their mean boss, and they come together to try to deal with him. And in one of the funnier scenes in the movie, the women all bond together smoking a joint and then developing the munchies and then eating all the ice cream and everything in the house. And it's a genuinely funny cultural moment in the movie. Apparently, at the end of the movie, Mrs. Reagan turned to Mr. Reagan and Michael Deaver and some other people in the room and said, that was a really good movie, except it showed these three women, all professionals, all mothers, smoking marijuana, and there was no ill consequence. They didn't get arrested. It didn't show the negative aspects of it. In her mind, it glorified marijuana use. And so she asked Mr. Deaver and Mr. Reagan that couldn't there be a way that Hollywood would not come out anymore with this sort of stuff. And Mr. Reagan, who came out of the Hollywood industry, was able to literally get then, there were seven corporate heads, he got them from Disney and Time Warner, et cetera, got them all in a room, got them all to agree that they would stop producing movies where people smoked marijuana. And if they did smoke marijuana, they had to show them, in the minds of the producers, the negative consequences of it, like getting arrested or developing a disease or something like that. And so the Partnership for a Drug-Free America, again, another absurd misnomer, began and is to this day the largest ad campaign in human history. It's bigger than Coca-Cola, bigger than Ford, bigger than GM, bigger than any commercial company you can name on Earth. That this has been the longest, most sustained ad campaign since 1986, and it has had virtually no effect on the attitudes or the rate of use of marijuana in the United States.
Now, I'm noticing that Normal has chapters worldwide. New Zealand, Norway, Canada. You are an international organization, aren't you?
Yeah, going back to the 1970s, a number of other countries have developed Normal chapters, and because America exported reefer madness all around the world, and because we, the American taxpayers, fund upwards of 95% of all the anti-marijuana research in the world, whether it's in New Zealand or Zimbabwe or Norway, that we, the American taxpayers, pay for all that stuff. So in some ways, we almost have to work around the world to stop the insanity created by the American government 74 years ago by banning marijuana.
And we're still paying for studies and anti-marijuana studies around the world? We're still paying for those?
We pay many hundreds of millions of dollars a year to have researchers all around the world produce nothing but anti-marijuana studies. And this system is so perverse and so intellectually dishonest that the head of the National Institute of Health, who ultimately would have to make the decisions about marijuana research, acknowledged in the New York Times 2 months ago that the United States government does not fund and will not allow research that looks at whether or not marijuana is useful, helpful, therapeutic. The only research it will fund and allow is to find out if marijuana is dangerous or not healthy for individuals. So the entire science of cannabis, one could say, is bogus in the sense that it's completely biasly manipulated by the United States government's funding and the fact that they have 100% monopoly on the plant material. No one in the United States, no researcher, can possess or use marijuana unless it comes from one farm the United States government sanctions at the University of Mississippi at Oxford.
Really?
My alma mater, University of Massachusetts at Amherst, has successfully sued the DEA to break this monopoly. The University of Mississippi has had this since 1978. So UMass, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, all these fine institutions cannot access marijuana unless they go through the government and two, they only study negative aspects of it.
That is alarming. I had no idea. And I don't even smoke, and I had no idea. I still, fair is fair, and this is not fair.
Well, this is why Normal exists. This is why wonks on K Street, such as we are, exist. And it's disturbing to see how intellectually dishonest and how irrational the government's war on marijuana and marijuana consumers has become.
Now, the Normal Foundation. I'm looking at your website. It says, the Normal Foundation, a sister organization to Normal. And I believe, I see an ad campaign with whom I believe is Mayor New York City's Mayor Bloomberg. And it says, you bet I did, and I enjoyed it. Is that right?
We launched a huge ad campaign in 2002 in New York City. Mayor Bloomberg, when he was first running for mayor, as now all politicians have to answer the question about whether they did or did not smoke marijuana, he acknowledged that not only did he smoke marijuana, he inhaled it and he enjoyed it. So we turned that into a rather large ad campaign.
And that's okay with him too?
No. He took some umbrage with the fact that we had used him as a poster boy,
mm-hmm.
but in good spirit he acknowledged, he said it, that it was all fair play for us to use, but he would be very happy when the campaign ended.
Oh, okay. That's very reasonable.
He's actually a very reasonable man.
Yeah, I remember when I lived in New York City, I found some of his ideas very, very reasonable. I'm going right through your website. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Now, the Normal PAC, it's the political arm of Normal. Tell us about the Normal PAC. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, presently, these laws are written and implemented by policymakers, and it was the policymakers 74 years ago that created marijuana prohibition. It's effectively only the federal politicians that can end marijuana prohibition. So at the state and federal level, Normal collects funding from our members to either give to candidates who favor reform or to put up money to oppose candidates who do not favor reform. And for probably a decade or more, we've collected and doled out tens of thousands of dollars to politicians who generally favor reform. And slowly but surely, those individuals are starting to have positive impact on the laws.
Excellent. And we'd also like to know about the educational programs. Are you allowed, as Normal as an organization, are you invited to academic programs? Are you invited to schools at all, or do you teach the youth about the pros and cons of cannabis at all? Do you have that opportunity, or are you, does society dissuade you from your organization from speaking to young people?
No, myself, I probably do between 30 and 40 college lectures every year. I'm a fellow at a number of educational institutes that specifically bring students to Washington, D.C. to learn about public policy. And the staff of Normal, along with our board, cumulatively probably speaks between 300 and 500 times a year at university, college, or high school settings.
Okay, and now we're going to get into the questions that the public is always asking. And when I looked at your frequently asked questions, it was alarming at how clearly aligned they were to the questions I received from my listeners. Who smokes marijuana?
Well, generally speaking, in the United States, the data suggests that the largest group is between 15 and 30 years old, that they're about 70-plus percent male, and that probably three-quarters of those in the government surveys that acknowledge that they use cannabis are between 15 and 30. Women use marijuana in the surveys at decidedly less rates, and we have all kinds of cross-tabulations regarding education levels and income levels. But largely speaking, it boils down to largely age, 15 to 30, and sex, male.
My word. And I'm noticing here, this is a wonderful quote by Jimmy Carter stating, and this was said by President Jimmy Carter, he acknowledged, penalties against drug use should not be more damaging to an individual than the use of the drug itself. Nowhere is this more clear than in the laws against the possession of marijuana in private for personal use. Talk to us about that.
Well, what he's speaking to is a Greek term called iatrogenic, which means that the cure is worse than the disease, and he's highlighted this by acknowledging that, yes, marijuana might be problematic, but arresting a young person and putting him in jail is worse. And so he acknowledged on August 3rd, 1977, in a message to Congress that marijuana ought to be at least decriminalized because it doesn't make sense to cause more harm to the individual through an arrest than it is to potentially tax them or to educate them about not using the substance.
And I have to ask, I mean, these questions are just so good. The Supreme Court, their recent ruling, tell us about that.
Which particular
About
ruling?
Medical marijuana.
There's been two cases. 2001, the Supreme Court ruled against medical marijuana, and in 2005, it again ruled against it. But it did so on very narrow grounds, and even though the court struck down some of these measures, the proliferation of medical marijuana has been even more acute. So some years ago, I had a chance to ask a Supreme Court justice at a symposium, and it happened to be the very same week that 24/7 vending machines for medical marijuana started popping up in California.
Wait a minute. Which can you say which Supreme Court member you spoke to?
No.
Oh, okay. All right. No, that's fine. Okay, go on.
Yeah, it was a private
He or she knows who he or she is.
Oh, he definitely knows who he is.
Okay, and that narrows it down. Go on.
And so the individual, the question was, the Supreme Court has struck down medical marijuana twice in a four-year period, but during that same period of time there's been an explosion of dispensaries, an explosion of patients, an explosion of state laws, and that very week, as I alluded to earlier, vending machines 24/7 were popping up in California. So my rhetorical question to this justice was, if reformers lost in the Supreme Court, what did they specifically lose?
And what was the answer?
The answer was a chuckle, a identification that I must be from normal, three, that he was going to acquit himself from answering the question specifically because he said, you know, we've taken two bites of the apple here. Why don't I think we'll be taking a third bite at it? And fourth, while I didn't answer the question specifically, I will acknowledge that there are times clearly where the American public is way far out ahead of the politicians and jurisprudence. And I thought his answer was perfectly politically attuned.
Yes, very politically correct and very careful, very cautious.
Mm-hmm. Like a Supreme Court justice.
Yes, absolutely. Now, this other wonderful question about critics of the medical use of marijuana, that they say that there are traditional medications to help patients and marijuana is not needed, and two, that permitting the medical use of marijuana sends the wrong message to kids. Could you tell me about that? Respond to that, please.
Well, the pox is on the house of the federal government who created the prohibition, one, and two, on the government that scheduled marijuana with heroin and cocaine, heroin and LSD, and didn't schedule it at Schedule 2 so that physicians could use it with their patients, like cocaine or morphine or mepidrine or ketamine or OxyContin or Percocet or Vicodin, all things that no one needs a degree in pharmacology to figure out that the government was out of its mind to place cannabis at such a high level and not treat it at least like morphine or OxyContin. And so it just simply doesn't pass the Joe Public stink test, number one. And number two, that this is not a camel's nose under the tent to legalize marijuana. When Normal sued the federal government in 1972 to reschedule marijuana, it didn't do so to make marijuana medically available. It did so because intellectually there was no possible way that an adult under the Controlled Substances Act was going to be able to go into their house in the privacy of their home and use cannabis if the government could prevail with the argument that marijuana is so dangerous and so deadly that it cannot be used under a doctor's supervision like OxyContin or morphine or Percocet, etc. And so, again, it is a completely intellectually dishonest argument for the government to keep arguing that cannabis be in Schedule 1 rather than at least Schedule 2.
I've always wondered, and I've always been suspicious. I've always assumed, are the religious groups behind this?
Generally not. In the early prohibitions at the state level from 1885 through around 1920, very often Pentecostal, Baptist, reborn Christian sects within particular states were the ones that, just like during alcohol prohibition, were the most agitated by people enjoying themselves or having euphoria or recreation from these substances. But historically, the five entities that oppose law reform and spend their time and money on this earth to maintain the status quo for marijuana prohibition are pretty straightforward. One are police and law enforcement. Two are the many, many, many federal and state bureaucracies born of the prohibition, like the DARE program or Partnership for Drug Free America or DEA or Drug Czar's Office, blah, blah, blah. Three would be alcohol, tobacco, and pharmaceutical companies who clearly the last thing in the world they really want is a, quote, drug-free America. And two, they realize that when marijuana is legal or available, that they lose at least a small percentage or market share of their drugs to marijuana. And fourth, which actually, in my view, is the most powerful lobby in the country against marijuana, but one that barely exists today, and that is parents groups, most specifically angry mothers. One of the biggest mistakes Normal made in the 1970s was not giving due deference to the men and women who are coming to Normal saying, listen, we're in favor of marijuana legalization or decriminalization, but you need to come out against children, 10, 12, 14-year-olds, smoking marijuana and growing marijuana and selling marijuana. And regrettably, Normal didn't take a stand against that back then. Today, we believe that marijuana ought to clearly be treated like alcohol and tobacco products, and that there's a certain age you can use them, and up until that point, it's a crime. And lastly, the one entity that most people would never think of, likely, as girding for the status quo would be what my friend and best-selling author Eric Schlosser writes about, the drug war military industrial complex, that drug testing companies, private prisons, the big high-tech companies that make the drug interdiction devices like ion scanners, things called gamma busters, all of these folks, you know, their products and services are not viable if marijuana is illegal. So for them, they keep putting money and time into lobbying to keep marijuana illegal, largely because it fits their parochial commercial needs.
Oh, I see. And who actually is the drug czar right now?
Current drug czar is the former chief of Seattle Police Force, a guy named Gil Kurlikowski.
Kurlikowski. It is Kurlikowski. I don't know how to pronounce the name, but I see the name here on your website. This individual, I guess he's very gung-ho against it, so I guess he's doing this job well. And I guess he's trying to spread this information nationwide, because I see he's doing a lot of publicity for that office.
Well, probably more disturbing, which very few people know.
Tell us. Tell us. Anything new, we want to know.
When people do come to realize it, they really not only get frustrated, but they then very quickly get mad, and that is that the Drug Czar's office, the charter, which was written by Vice President Joe Biden back when he was a senator from Delaware in the 1980s, that the charter of the Drug Czar's office has one of the most profound anti-little-d democratic clauses found in the American government, and that is the Drug Czar must oppose and fight any legal efforts to legalize marijuana. So whether or not Mr. Kurlikowski actually cares about marijuana or not, for him to get and retain his job and to maintain the charter of the office, he must by law oppose the will of the American people, which makes he and his office decidedly anti-little d democratic, which is an anathema in a democratic country.
Now, who wrote their charter anyway?
Joseph Biden.
You're kidding. I'll be. When did he write? How far back did he write it? I mean, it can't be that far back. We didn't have a drug czar, you know, more than 10 years ago. So, what, 3 or 4 years ago?
No, it was the drug czar's office began in 1984.
Well, I'll be the drug czar. And this fellow, then, he's committed to fight everything and anything anyway.
Right. So even when confronted by truth, science, compassion, morality, voters and their majorities, he is chartered by law to oppose the American people.
Mm. Well, I don't care what different communities do. I only concern myself with what I see with my own eyes. And I'm noticing that there are tremendously beautiful, beautiful counties all throughout Florida, all suffering the typical economic plight that we're all suffering from. And if we were to take a page from what's going on in Mendocino, I think with our growing weather, I mean, we've got beautiful weather. We in Florida, they should certainly consider growing legal marijuana to fill these empty coffers and legalize it so that they can control it and tax it and do in Florida what they did in Mendocino, California. Do you think that's too outrageous a possibility?
Yes, in the short term. Florida is in the tier of states that is pretty much off the radar scope for reformers. The current group of politicians there have no compunction whatsoever to pass reforms, even medical marijuana laws. People like Bill McCollum, who looks to be likely your next governor, has been an anti-marijuana zealot his entire political career, and now he's going to be your governor. So,
are you sure of that? I mean, can we make book on that? I'll be in Vegas in a week if you're telling me that that's the case. You know for sure he's going to be the governor?
Well, there's a Republican and a Democrat. When was the last time you had a Democratic? When was the last time was a Democratic governor of the state?
I can't speak on the Florida politics. I'm from New York. I'm a transplant, like everyone else.
Generally speaking, Florida is a state that hews much more towards the Republicans and the red side, and so I can't even tell you the name of who the Democrat is running. But Mr. McCollum is the sitting Attorney General. He was the former congressman.
Yeah.
He's been representing Florida for 35 to 40 years in the House. So he is completely dialed in, and very likely going to be Florida's next governor.
My word, I didn't know that. No, not at all. Not at all. And I wanted to ask you about shipping and transport. I mean, moving marijuana from one place to another, I mean, isn't it still as highly illegal as it would be to move any other drug? The reason I mention that is because I really don't want someone in Mendocino to buy some medical marijuana and then get on a plane to Chicago or something. People still have to be as careful as ever about taking any type of drug on their person, their body, or their luggage anywhere. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely.
And are there any other words of wisdom? People want to, for instance, help your organization, Normal, what steps do you recommend they take? Should they go to your website or to the local chapter?
Well, probably the webpage is a very good first place to go, and people can contact Normal in Washington, D.C. There are 145 to 150 chapters in the United States. People should certainly, when locating the closest chapter to them, join it and get involved at the local level, because most of the law reform actually occurs at the local and state level. There is very, very little reform at the federal level traditionally. So, joining a Normal chapter, getting fully informed, attending Normal conferences, seminars, events. We put on huge what are called protestivals, protest and festivals, where we're protesting the laws while we're celebrating cannabis at the same time. And so for those who can make it to Seattle in the third week of August, there'll be, as there always is, about 200,000 to 250,000 cannabis advocates that show up at a huge park on the side of the bay and put on really, truly one of the largest public protests in the United States for the last 20 years.
And yourself, I mean, you've been with this organization for such a long time, and you seem to be handling things very professionally. What is your direction in the next, say, 5 years with Normal? Where are you leading them?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, the organization has much more work ahead of it. No state has legalized marijuana to date. So Normal's charter is to legalize marijuana in the United States. So, there's probably some years, 5 or 10 years, before most, if not all, of the 50 states have some kind of marijuana laws on the books. So there'll be a lot of work for many years to come at Normal for legalization. But once marijuana is legalized, I think it's an important question to ask, well, what will Normal do then? And, of course, it's up to the board of directors, but I suspect that what will happen is that the organization will go from being a 40-year advocacy group to change the laws to being effectively like a trade association group that represents the interests of those who make, sell, and consume cannabis, and will probably come at it more like a Consumer Reports organization rather than a NAACP or ACLU, where we're trying to achieve or strive for rights. Once those rights are achieved, we will work hard to protect them.
And I see the news on your website. It's fascinating. Anyone who's curious about this, the address is www.norml.org. And there's an entire history here about state. It's a state-by-state history showing the news as to legalization, as to medical marijuana, as to the penalties for possession or carrying it or using it. Do you think in our lifetime we'll see it?
Yeah, I think it's a fait accompli that starting with California either this year with Prop 19 or in 2012 if this fails, or 2014, it just seems very implausible to me that Californians are not vote in the affirmative to legalize marijuana sometime very soon. And once they do that, a number of states, maybe 8 to 12 states, will follow them very quickly and will start in on an era in the United States like we had during after alcohol prohibition, where some states will allow it, some states will not, and ultimately all states will, but they might have very different degrees of laws, and in many cases there are still, I think, 600 to 700 dry counties in the United States, and I suspect there will be many, many hundreds of dry counties or towns where marijuana is not allowed to be sold, but adults can legally possess it in their home.
My gosh, that's been fantastic. I can't tell you how informative you've been. This is Syndicated News. We've spent an hour with Alan St. Pierre, the Executive Director of Normal and the Normal Foundation. Thank you so much for your visiting us and giving us all this information. We had no idea it was this extensive.
My pleasure, and it's a very fascinating topic, particularly for those who are interested in marijuana.
Thank you so much for visiting us. We so appreciate it. We so appreciate it. And now we're going to close with the keys. The Keys Disease. Thank you.
My pleasure.
At the crack of noon, I got so much to do today. Head on down to the Shiki Bar just to watch the tourists play. Living just south of reality, mile marker 49. Some folks say that I'm wasting my life, but I say I'm doing just fine. See, I've got the keys to these, in case you haven't heard. I've got the keys to these, mañana is the operative word. There's no cure for the keys to these, no mainland antidote. I'll never leave my island life at the end. The American road. Well, I once was a lawyer long time ago, before I lost my student eye. Traded my car for a beat-up bike, kissed my old life goodbye. The last slept on the beach, neath the moon and stars, slept under a bridge or two. Not because I didn't have a place to stay, it's just because I wanted to. See, I've got the keys to these, in case you haven't heard. I've got the keys to these. operative word. There's no cure for the keys to me, no mainland antidote. Well, I'll never leave my island alive as I have. The American road. You may wonder why a man like me would leave his whole life behind. No phone or beeper's gonna be my keeper. I'm living on tropical time. Sunset time in the Florida Keys, so many things to do. Hit the sunset party down at Mallory Dock and have a rum runner or two. The pirates of today are the ones like me, living life the way we please. Well, I know for sure that there ain't no cure once you got the Keys disease. You see, I've got the Keys disease, in case you haven't heard. Yes, I've got the Keys disease. Manana is the operative word. There's no cure for the